Good afternoon to all of you, and welcome to our many special guests that are here today. We're always thrilled to have you here. There is a magazine I thought I'd bring your attention to. We can put it back on the table if you'd like to look at it later. This is the Oklahoma magazine, the March issue, and it has has a short article in here about the about God's house, and the it's really quite beautiful the way they've done that and from the drawing. And so we'll put that back on the table and let you see it. It's really, really a fabulous picture, and it's the updated version with the roof raised higher. And there might possibly be a piece of sculpture in that pool there. We're not sure about that yet. But anyhow, we'll put that up there for you. And Mr. Brandon and all the crew are working very hard to meet our deadline. That's always a difficult thing to do. I certainly did enjoy and was moved by that stirring and powerful music. We've come a long way in a few years, and I know if Mr. Armstrong could have been here, he'd have loved that. So it really was an outstanding performance, I thought. I don't have anything specific to tell you about the Jerusalem dig, but I did want to tell you what I know and what we've been told. I think a lot is heating up in Jerusalem, as you know from the news. But also there's some astonishing things happening in the even in the field of archaeology that will concern us, I think, in some ways, before this is all over. And I thought, too, there's a special comment here by the mayor of Jerusalem, and I thought it would be more meaningful if I read to you a comment that was made, or a news report that was read from the at the Bible study last night, a very powerful Bible study, I might say. But this is from the Secretary of State Clinton. There will be a Palestinian state, Jerusalem capital, and here is a comment that she made. This is an article about that. I just want to read a few paragraphs here. On Wednesday, Clinton all but guaranteed that her government will clash with Benjamin Netanyahu when she suggested in a joint press conference with Palestinian leader Mahmoud Abbas that for Washington, the division of Jerusalem is a foregone conclusion. And of course, the Netanyahu just barely did win, and he hasn't even put together a government yet, so it's deeply divided over there. So you can imagine that comments like that can really be very harmful and can also stir up some opposition, I would think. Speaking to reporters in Ramallah, Clinton said she was not pleased with the Jerusalem municipality's plans to demolish 80 Arab homes on the city's eastern side that were built without proper permits. Clearly, this kind of activity is unhelpful and not in keeping with the obligations entered into under the roadmap. And what kind of obligations do they have after what the terrorists have done? Just an outrageous statement. It's an issue that we intend to raise with the government of Israel and the government at the municipal level in Jerusalem, which means the mayor. Okay, they're going to raise that issue, she might be surprised when she does. Clinton's remarks suggested that the Obama administration does not recognize Israeli sovereignty over the eastern half of Jerusalem. Isn't that dumbfounding that one of our cabinet members would make such a statement as that about another nation and supposedly our best friend in the Middle East? Insulting beyond words to even explain. But anyhow, they don't have sovereignty over the eastern half of Jerusalem any more than it does the so-called West Bank. Observers argued she also legitimized lawlessness on the part of eastern Jerusalem's Arab populations by suggesting that they are not subject to the authority of the Jerusalem municipality. In other words, the mayor of Jerusalem doesn't have authority over East Jerusalem, which would be inciting people to riot or kill or do anything they wanted to do and even cause terrorism to be on the rise there in Jerusalem. And will eventually, happen. We know Zechariah 14 verses 1 and 2 says that they're going to take one half of Jerusalem by force, and all of the raping and pillage and everything that comes with that. That's what our government is helping to bring about, helping the terrorists. Now, just to show how good we are, though, our government has already pledged nearly $1 billion to rebuild Gaza. And with all the money they're going to be getting from Europe and the U.S., they could build a city that probably as beautiful as anyone in this world, but I don't think they'll probably use it to build a city, that money. I think most of it will be used to buy weapons and guns to conquer half of Jerusalem. Isn't that the way the terrorists usually operate? They're not really too much into architecture, except they like to tear it apart, it seems to me. But here we are helping the number one terrorist sponsoring nation in the world. Everybody knows that that's an arm of Iran. Everybody knows that. And so we have so much money. We're so many $1 trillion in debt now, we don't even know how much debt and indebtedness we have. But here we'll just go to China and borrow another $1 billion and then give it to Gaza. Or if we can't get it from China, we'll just print dollar bills and give all that money to the terrorists. What a fantasy world we live in. What a fantasy world our people are in. And look at the damage they're doing to our only real friend in the Middle East. The number one terror sponsoring nation in the world, the King of the South. Now they're helping those terrorists. They want to negotiate with those Arab Nazis as if that's going to do any good. They haven't learned anything from history because they think they soar above history. And any lessons there, the founding fathers, why they are so much more intelligent than those people, they think. And they're destroying Israel. Now I want to give you the municipality's response, the mayor's response. Here's what the Washington Post wrote. This is by Howard Snyder, Friday, March the 6th. After Secretary of State Hillary Rodham Clinton this week criticized plans to extend a park across 88 buildings that house Palestinian families in East Jerusalem, newly elected Jerusalem Mayor Nir Barkat said that she was meddling in local control over zoning and the city's economic future. The threatened homes were built without permits and should not be there in the first place, Burkett told reporters Thursday, while the Envision Park, running from beneath the walls of the old city across a valley associated with the Old Testament kings, would draw more tourists to the city that could use the boost. And here Burkett said, "I totally reject the criticism. It is a lot of air. There is no substance. Maybe it is because there is a new administration in the States." He speculated that she had been misled by what he called Palestinian disinformation. And Nir Barkat is really a very good friend of Ilhan Mazar. In fact, she talked to him a few minutes even at this latest Jerusalem conference that we attended. But this article goes on, but Burkett and many other Israelis, including Jewish settler organizations, don't want the city divided. Settlers have begun moving into some Arab neighborhoods, while expansion, you can see what they're trying to do. They're trying to drive Netanyahu from power even before he can form a government, if he can. And it's going to be a razor-thin edge that he'll have, even if he's able to do that. And so they're trying to destroy the Israeli government by their aggression, and the only time it seems like they'll get really aggressive if it's when they're trying to, at this point, destroy their own Israelite brothers. And there's a lot to be said about that that I'll talk about later, or later after this sermon, perhaps. But anyhow, settlers have begun moving into Arab neighborhoods, while expansion plans have been set for existing settlements, such as Mael Adumim, further to the east near the floor of the Kidron Valley, where Palestinians have erected a standing protest tent over plans for the park. A long rectangular Israeli flag hangs down the side of one building, showing the cheek by jowl nature of the conflict. But listen to this. To Palestinians, the strategy seems clear. Expand the Israeli presence to the east, allow more Jewish families to build in Arab neighborhoods, and make it harder for future negotiators to divide control of the city. Residents of the affected sliver of land in Silwan, that's where the city of David is, residents of the affected sliver of land in Silwan say their area is a potential flashpoint. Now, I wonder why that is. Why would that area be a flashpoint? Right in the very area where we are probably going to do some more digging, and have already done some, but you can see why we need to pray, be praying about that, brethren. Did you ever wonder? Well, I know you have, and thought about that a lot, but why is it that in the midst of all this worldly turmoil, we're talking about wars and nations, and right in the middle of that, there is usually a flashpoint, and there you find God's people. Strange, isn't it? Or is it? What are we doing there? And may very well be getting more involved. Berkat, 3 months into the job, says he doesn't want to ignore Palestinian concerns. He says he wants to provide better services in East Jerusalem, improve planning and speed permit approval, assuming park or plans for the park move ahead after expected court appeals. Now, this is what we're waiting on and why we need your prayers, because this does seem to be moving pretty fast. But that has to be settled before we can go ahead and help send students there to help dig in that area of Silwan. He said there may be some compensation or relocation help for residents, and an acknowledgement that this is a sensitive area. But the former paratrooper also said he would make no promises about the homes in Silwan, despite what the U.S. Secretary of State might have to say. Quote, "I'm not willing to say the houses will remain houses. It is the wrong signal to send to people who break the law," Barkat said. Just before Barkat's planned session with foreign correspondents, a Palestinian driver used a bulldozer to ram a bus and a police car in Jerusalem before police and bystanders shot him dead. There have been two similar rampages by Palestinian driving construction vehicles in Jerusalem in recent months. At the scene, Barkat called for stricter punishment on such attackers, including the demolition of their houses. And now it's very conceivable that we could be, that is, our government could be stirring up more violence in Jerusalem. That's the way we're conducting ourselves today. Just a couple of more short paragraphs here about this. This is from the AP. I think that was Friday or Thursday, I forget which. But anyhow, they're talking about the Silwan area again. Silwan, where the city of David is, and where we're digging, a ramshackle neighborhood in East Jerusalem, sits atop a site Israelis call the City of David, named for the biblical monarch who ruled a Jewish kingdom from the spot 3,000 years ago. Jews consider the site an essential link to their ancient history, and the government has designated it an archaeological park. Palestinian residents of Silwan worry that the current City of David Museum is just the beginning of a massive redesign of the area to complete the archaeological park. The park land is allocated by the government, but developed by the Elon Foundation, that's the City of David people, an organization associated with Jewish settlers committed to preventing Israel from ceding the area in a peace deal. So we're walking right in there and making bold statements. But it's astonishing, brethren, when we think about how God, as his people, right in the middle of all of these conflagrations in the world, and we're throughout history, we've always been right there. And God says, in this end time, we are going to prevail. We are going to prevail. Let's look at Isaiah 22 and verse 20 and focus on the king of, or the key of the house of David today. Isaiah 22 and verse 20. And it shall come to pass in that day that I will call my servant Eliakim, the son of Hilkiah, and will clothe him with your robe and strengthen him with your girdle, and I will commit your government into his hand, and he shall be a father to the inhabitants of Jerusalem and to the house of Judah. So this Eliakim office is a father to the house, to the inhabitants of Jerusalem, but and this, of course, is spiritual, but just a father to the house of Judah. Not to the inhabitants of Judah, but to the house of Judah. In other words, God says there would be a work, I think a very strong work, in Judah. And we, God's people, would be right there when all of these prophecies are unfolding. God's people would be there. Verse 22. And the key of the house of David will I lay upon his shoulder, so he shall open and none shall shut, and he shall shut and none shall open. So here this office has the key of the house of David, a man. And Mr. Armstrong and I both discovered that we are of the house of David and the lineage of David and the house of Judah. And I think if you look at even the context here, you would probably have to say that it even implies that this Eliakim would be from the house of Judah and the house of David. But why is that, brethren? Is God trying to exalt a man above everybody else or an office above everybody else? Why is it God is putting so much emphasis on the house of Judah and the house of David and the inhabitants of Jerusalem? Why is God putting our focus there so much? Well, this is about really a big part of the key of the house of David is that scepter promise, which is, as we know, the kingly line from David's throne, which continues right on down to the second coming of Jesus Christ when he gives grace or salvation to all the world, to the whole world. And he's going to have some people there from this era right there in the headquarters at Jerusalem to be, as you heard last night in the Bible study, to be co-saviors, to work with Jesus Christ to save the world. That's quite a calling, to save the world. And it's almost here. The bride of Christ is going to be there to help him. That scepter promise is about a kingly line. And all of those kings were of the line of Judah and the lineage of David. And it all, every one of them leads step by step by step right down to the return of Jesus Christ. Christ also was from the house of Judah and the house of David. And God keeps trying to make us understand that we are a part of a fabulous future that can cause us to transcend the problems we face today and rise above them and overcome and grow and become converted as you heard last night, and get ready for that time. Here we have students over there that have helped to uncover David's palace, which is really a symbol of all of those kings, all of that royal power from David at the very beginning. And now here's that palace of David again, right here before Christ returns. And we're digging there, and God wants us to get our focus on the rule on David's throne with Christ and help him save this crazy, crazy world. It can't last much longer. It wouldn't, even if they didn't have nuclear bombs, you think they couldn't last much longer. Everything is so upside down and wrong, and it seems like our leaders know so little. But the conclusion of all of this, the scepter promise, is what God wants us to focus on. Sure, it goes all the way back to King David, but we're over there digging on a site where Christ is undoubtedly going to place his throne, or the David's throne, for his return, and from where he's going to rule. And he wants us to get our minds on that and keep our minds on that, because if we don't, we're going to be like 95% of God's people who didn't like to hear us talk about the line of Judah, or the house of David, or the house of Judah, or the inhabitants of Jerusalem. Well, they get into that, they talk about that in the United States and Britain in prophecy, they say. And they tell us that's prejudice, that's bias against the Gentiles. In their ignorance, they don't even see or refuse to see that God is giving that to all people in this world. They're all going to be part of Israel. But he is calling out a few now to catch that vision and see what God is trying to get us to understand. That if we don't have something to focus on that throne of David, we're going to do like 95% of God's people and just totally lose the vision in dangerous, gross ignorance. There's no excuse for it. And God says, okay, you do this work, this Eliakim, you do the work. I'll give you the key of the house of David, and you will be able to open doors and deliver this message not only to Israel, but to Judah and even the whole world. And there's nothing this world needs more than this message. Nothing compares to this message. What a powerful message it is. Notice Genesis 49 and verse 1. So easy to lose this vision, and that's what it is, when God talks about the key of the house of David. Notice verse 1, and Jacob called unto his sons and said, gather yourselves together that I may tell you that which shall befall you in the last days. Amazing. God is talking about the last days here in the first book of Genesis. What is he trying to get us to see? What does he want us to know? Well, here's a big part of it for these last days. Here's a major part of it. Verse 10, the scepter shall not depart from Judah, and a lawgiver from between his feet, or who descends from Judah, until Shiloh, or Christ, come. And unto him shall the gathering of the people be. So here is that scepter promise, and it's not going to depart from Judah. Does that mean God exalts Judah above everybody else? No, it doesn't. But he says they're going to have that scepter promise, and that's quite an honor for a nation to be given this honor. that is something to behold. But God says there's also going to be a lawgiver there, and those who support that lawgiver. And that lawgiver is going to continue alongside that scepter promise until Shiloh come. until the second coming. You see where the emphasis is and the focus is? If we don't see the end and if we don't have the vision, we're not going to be there at the end. We're going to let some sin take us away from God in this evil world instead of seeing where all this should be leading all of us and inspiring all of us to work toward. The lawgiver continues right on down to the conclusion of the scepter promise. And that's in the first book of the Bible. See what a vision this key of the house of David is? And it's saying, brethren, to all of you that you are spiritual Jews and that you are law keepers and that you do want to be co-saviors with Jesus Christ when He gets here, and we don't have very much time to get ready. Look at how fast it's all happening. You want to just fritter away your time? Well, I don't think we do. Scepter means kingly office, royal power. And who is more royal than the very elect today? Who is more royal? Who ought to understand about scepter more than anybody else? The people that are going to rule right there in Jerusalem headquarters forever. And the Laodiceans are not going to be there because they just couldn't rise above their sins. They just couldn't yield themselves and commit themselves to God and just let this slip away from them. So easy to do in this very evil world. I mean, this, if we really understand that scepter promise, it just takes us step by step by step to that throne that Christ is going to sit on, when He's going to sit on it. And He's telling us who we are. Who are we? Brethren, who are we? Can we sin? Can we get involved in this world and yield to Satan, the devil, and still share that throne with Jesus Christ? Well, as you heard last night in the Bible study, well, how are we going to teach those people conversion? That is, how to become God. If we're not acting like God ourselves, if we're not thinking like God, how are we going to teach them how to be like, become God? Well, it's impossible, isn't it? It's impossible. Do you know who you are? You're certainly the highest royalty from the end time eras, two eras, that's for sure. Because God says, I'm going to put you right there at headquarters and you'll never go anymore out. I'm not going to send you out. Your job is too critical. You have to stay here in Jerusalem and help Christ from headquarters. That's what the key of how the house of David is really all about. What does that dig, archaeological dig, really symbolize? What does it symbolize, brethren? It symbolizes us ruling in headquarters forever. Now, that's what it's about. I mean, when you think about that dig, you better really think about, well, what is this all about? We do need physical symbols to help us understand what God wants us to do. But He wants us to have a very high standard and keep lifting that standard higher and higher and higher, so that we can be there and help Him save humanity. That's quite a calling, and it extends on out into the universe. But what do you see when you see the archaeological dig? And I don't know how involved we'll be there. Only God knows. We'll have to wait and see. But I suspect there's more. Dr. Mazar wanted to dig for a long time before she got started, but it took her 10 years to get started. And that just happened to synchronize with the time that we could get in on it and help her. Interesting, isn't it? Now, we've already uncovered a gold mine, over there, and if we didn't uncover anything else, I mean, really, it's quite a powerful message. But here's what we wrote October 30th in thetrumpet.com. The tunnels, talking about the tunnel, the tunnel's characteristics, date, and location testify with high probability that the water tunnel is the one called Tishnor in the story of the King of David, in the story of the King of David's conquest of Jerusalem, said Mazar. In order to excavate the continuation, Mazar said, proper reinforcements need to be constructed. Only once the Babylonians laid siege upon the city in 585 B.C., however, the tunnel was lost from world view and forgotten until now. Now, Dr. Mazar doesn't understand about that tunnel the way we do, but she does think it's the tunnel mentioned in Scripture that Joab used to get in there and conquer the Jebusites for David and give control of that area to David, and of course it became Jerusalem. Now, I believe she could be right, but we don't know for sure. I think we'll find out more perhaps as we go along. But the reason I think she could be right is because David, then when he went into Jerusalem, he united all of Israel and he became ruler over all of Israel. And of course, that throne of David is going to be used to unite the whole world. It's going to unite all of Israel, and of course the Gentiles will be grafted in and they'll become a part of Israel, and that throne will unite the whole world. So I think that is significant, and it could very well be that very tunnel. I mean, you can see how difficult it is even to unite Israel today. Look at how we're at loggerheads with Judah here in Manasseh, and very much at loggerheads now with Britain. I'll try to cover that in another sermon. But it's hard to unite Israel. It's hard to unite a church. God has to have a method of rule to unite the people. And he wants us to learn how that's done so we can teach it to the world. Now that is real, and that's the only thing that is going to save this world. It's the only thing that will save them. If people want to fight God, if they want to divide, if they want to turn away from God or resist God and resist conversion, well, they're not ever going to be able to unite the world and help unite all the world. I mean, that is what God is going to do, and that's why we're here. It is about uniting the world, because God isn't going to send us out into the universe until that is accomplished. And we're just confined to this earth. Or worse, well, still confined to the earth, I guess, with our ashes, if we don't get beyond this world and try to show this world how to become united. Look at the division here, even about the archaeological digs. I'll just read you a couple of comments from thetrumpet.com again. This one from March 2006, the second one from May 2007, but it says, skeptical of the Bible's account, archaeologists have long debated to what extent Jerusalem was an important city or even a city in the time of David and Samuel. That's from the Times of London. Some scholars suggest that King David and Solomon were nothing more than petty tribal chieftains who ruled over an area comprising little more than a few scattered rural clans. One renowned archaeologist has even hypothesized that Jerusalem during David's time was nothing more than a typical hill country village. International Herald Tribune, August 5th, 2005. Some scholars go even further, suggesting that the biblical account of King David is nothing more than a myth. What's wrong with this world? I mean, there's all kinds of evidence. What's wrong with these people? How can you unite such hard-headed, unconverted people? Well, probably only with a sword. Another comment. This revisionist history has even been accepted by certain Israeli scholars. Ginsburg noted, quote, Israel Finkelstein, chairman of Tel Aviv University's Department of Archaeology, began championing a theory several years ago that the biblical accounts of Jerusalem as the seat of a powerful unified monarchy under the rule of David and Solomon are essentially false. This is Israel Finkelstein, of all people, and with a name like that. Well, I'm talking about Israel, not Finkelstein. but think about it. His first name's Israel. Israel. And here's what he thinks. He concluded that David and Solomon, if they existed at all, were merely hill country chieftains, and Jerusalem, a poor, small tribal village. He claims that the myth of King David was the creation of a cult of priests trying to create for themselves a glorious history. Now, he's the one that has some conflict with Dr. Mazar from time to time. I think you can understand why. But is that just the best he can do with all of his research and study? Is that the best he can do? Or is he prejudiced and biased against God? You can see, now again, about that tunnel, here's another possibility that it could lead to, as Nehemiah said in chapter 2 and verse 3, I'm not going to turn there, but it says, the place of my father's sepulchres lies waste, and the gates thereof are consumed with fire. So, could our next find be the tombs of the kings? And the reason I say that, brethren, is it seems to me that if you found the tombs of the kings, I mean, it would just take the most fanatical, rabid person and scholarly person in the world, I guess, to disagree at that point that, well, this just couldn't, the Jews didn't live here in the past. They didn't have a past in this area. So it seems to me that might be a conclusive piece of evidence if we were to find that, and maybe the tunnel will lead to that. But here's what we wrote, even though the Babylonians had left the entire city in ruin early on in the 6th century B.C., Nehemiah knew right where David's palace had been built. Nehemiah 12, verse 37. He knew exactly where David's palace was. Well, why would he want to know that? Why would Nehemiah want to know about David's throne? And the tombs of the kings. What's so important about that? It's not important to Israel Finkelstein. What's so important about that? Well, if we understand about the scepter promise and the key of the house of David and all of that, we know exactly why Nehemiah was so concerned about that. In verse 16, Nehemiah mentions the tombs of the kings of Judah, which have not yet been discovered today. But putting Nehemiah's description together with Dr. Mazar keeps finding, and what Dr. Mazar keeps finding in the city of David, they must be close by. Seems like the Jews are always forgetting their own history. And again, you see, the carnal mind is enmity against God. But what if the tunnel led us into the tombs of the kings? The kings that sat on David's throne, that God promised would be there, that throne would have a king on it, or a king to sit on it, or a ruler to sit on it, from David's time all the way to the coming of the Messiah. Now that's important, because we've got to get the end result of this. We have to see the end of all this, or it's not that important. Where is this really leading? How real is the return of Jesus Christ to each one of us? Well, I'll tell you, brethren, we better be attending all the Bible studies we can. God says we'd better do it. So much more as you see that day approaching. And if you miss one like you last night, well, then you're going to miss a lot. You really are. But all the findings over there, you just look how significant each one of them are. David's palace, that's about the first temple. Nehemiah's wall, that's about the second temple. Today we are the temple. But those are just real powerful symbols that helps to establish the Bible world. The Bible world, and that's what the Jews are having problems with today, and all of Israel for that matter, but it really is something they talk about occasionally. They think that might be the cause of their problems. Now let me show you something. Jeremiah 1 is about Jeremiah's commission, and I think may have some lessons for us that we have yet to see, because it's tied in with our commission. Notice that in Jeremiah 1 in verse 4. Then the word of the Eternal came unto me, saying, Before I formed you in the belly, I knew you, and before you came forth out of the tomb, I sanctified you, and I ordained you a prophet unto the nations. Verses 4 and 5. Now verse 6. Then said I, Ah, Lord God, behold, I cannot speak, for I'm a child. He was quite young, probably in his late teens. And there's always those excuses. You young people can make excuses. But what did God tell him? If God calls us, He says, just get busy and do it. Do what I tell you. Verse 7, But the Lord said unto me, Say not that I am a child, for you shall go to all that I shall send you. And whatsoever I command you, you shall speak. You'd be wise to heed that, young people. He commands it. It's a heavy responsibility. You can say, well, with Jeremiah, well, I'm young. God couldn't expect too much of me. I'm just a teenager. I'm just into my 20s or 30s. God surely wouldn't expect too much of me. You better look at these prophecies and what He says to all of us about what He expects. And it is a heavy responsibility. Verse 8, Be not afraid of their faces, for I am with you to deliver you, says the Eternal. Jeremiah knew he would encounter a lot of trouble, and did he ever. And I'll talk to you about a little of that. God said, Don't be afraid of them. I'm right there with you. Even when you're in prison, I'm right there with you. Verse 9, Then the Eternal put forth His hand and touched my mouth, and the Eternal said unto me, Behold, I have put my words in your mouth. I put my words in your mouth. Has He put His words in the mouths of you young people and all of us? Yes, He has. Verse 10, See, I have this day set you over the nations and over the kingdoms to root out, to take the throne of David out of Jerusalem, to their shame, and to pull down, and to destroy, and to throw down, to build, and to plant. See, that reveals Jeremiah's commission. He had to not only root out, but he had to plant. He had to plant. It was a hard, hard fight for Jeremiah to do what he had to do. But God says, Jeremiah, and even when he was up to his ears in that muck and mire of prison, said, I am going to use you to root out and to take this throne and build and plant. And Jeremiah believed him, though it looked like he was going to die. He was used in rooting out the throne from Judah. But the Jews and all of us, brethren, need to know, well, what happened to Jeremiah before he uprooted this throne and took it to Iron? What happened to him before that? We know that he warned Judah. We know that he warned them very strongly about what was going to happen, and we know that he had to suffer quite a lot But you know something? We've been digging a lot of that information, in a way, right out of the ground over there in the archaeological dig. We certainly have. I wonder why. Wonder why these are the bullas we're finding. Let me read this to you. 3 years ago, Mazar found another seal with the name of Jukal, the son of Shelemiah, mentioned twice in the book of Jeremiah. The Jukal bulla was found on the platform above the stepstone structure where Dr. Mazar has uncovered a small section of what used to be King David's palace. This was written July 31st, 2008 in thetrumpet.com. She also said, we found the bulla of Jukal inside the palace structure. Mazar told thetrumpet.com yesterday. This time we found the bulla of Gedaliah outside the wall, just at the foot of the same spot we found Jehukal. The two must have been connected somehow, she said. And then we mention here both princes. The Bible relates unsuccessfully petitioned for Jeremiah's execution and were responsible for his imprisonment on two separate occasions. And isn't it interesting? We just happened to find those two bullas. Was that just an accident? Was that just coincidence? I don't think it probably was. I mean, when you think about it, isn't that kind of a terrifying warning for Judah? And really, it's a type of for all Israel today. Jeremiah didn't just talk to Judah in his book. He talks to Israel and warns them. And that's only a type for Judah, it's really a message for all of Israel. All of Israel. Now, Babylon ruled over Israel even before they besieged them, and they are the ones that put King Zedekiah in charge. Let's take a look at what happened. You know, King Zedekiah, I guess I can go ahead in this story to the end, where they took all of his sons. They wanted to put a stop to this throne of David stuff. They killed all of his sons right before his eyes. Now, this happened in Judah. This is their history. This is when the throne of David was taken away from Jerusalem. And they killed all of his sons right before his eyes. And then after that was over, they put his eyes out and took him to Babylon. And he died in prison in Babylon. Now, the Gentiles can be pretty rough, but they're going to be a lot rougher in the near future than they were then. And that's a fact, brethren. This is what we're facing if we don't have God taking care of us. This is our future. Notice Jeremiah 37 in verse 1. And King Zedekiah, the son of Josiah, reigned instead of these other guys in I don't think I need to mention all that. Verse 2. Verse 2, it just tells about how they ignored the message. Verse 3. And Zedekiah the king sent Jehukal, the son of Shelemiah, and Zephaniah, the son of Maaseiah, the priest to the prophet Jeremiah, saying, pray now unto the Eternal our God. Now Jeremiah came in and went out among the people, for they had not put him into prison. So he's going around warning them. But here is that Jehukal, the son of Shelemiah, right there in the context of Jeremiah's warning. Now, Jeremiah 38 verse 1, you've heard these before, but I think it's necessary that you hear them again. Verse 8, then Shephatiah, the son of Malton, and Gedaliah, the son of Pasher, there's one of the bullas that we found of this guy, and Jukal, here's the other one, the son of Shelemiah, and Pasher, the son of Malchiah, heard the words that Jeremiah had spoken unto all the people, saying. Now here are these princes, these leaders of Judah, and they heard Jeremiah talking. And of course, they loved what they heard, right? No, they didn't like it at all. Now, this is, I think, a powerful warning that these men, brethren, heard the word of God. They heard the message of God from the great Jeremiah, one of three men in the Bible, including Christ, that were called from the womb. And they heard what God had to say. Words from His mouth, He said. Verse 2, thus says the Eternal, he that remains in this city shall die by the sword, by the famine, and by pestilence. But he that goes forth to the Chaldeans shall live, for he shall have his life for a prey and shall live. Thus says the Eternal, the city shall surely be given unto the hand of the king of Babylon's army, which shall take it. Therefore the princes said unto the king, we beseech you, those princes we have the two bullas representing today. The princes said unto the king, we beseech you, let this man be put to death. For thus he weakens the hands of the men of war that remain in this city, and the hands of all the people, in speaking such words unto them. For this man seeks not the welfare of this people, but the hurt. See, he's discouraging the people. You know what they're going to say about us. Well, we're discouraging the people. They have no confidence in the stock market or anything else. The people are all discouraged because of the message of those people from that church. But I'd say these bullets are two pretty strong warnings against Judah and against Israel. Again, the book of Jeremiah is addressed to Israel. It's for all of us. But they accuse Jeremiah of weakening the army and the people. And this was the last king of Judah, the last one. And he was killed or put in prison by Babylon. And we're going to undoubtedly deal with the last king of Judah in some respect, in some measure, even if it isn't Mr. Netanyahu. But there is a modern Babylon that's on the scene. It's going to be a lot worse than this other Babylon. In 585 BC, when they destroyed Judah. Verse 5, here's what the great Zedekiah told them. Zedekiah the king said, behold, he is in your hand, for the king is not is not he that can do anything against you. I don't know how weak he was, but he certainly didn't try to save Jeremiah. Verse 6, and then they took Jeremiah and cast him into the dungeon of Malchiah the son of Amalek that was in the court of the prison. And they let down Jeremiah with cords. And in the dungeon there was no water but mire. So Jeremiah sunk in the mire. And then he was going to soon die, and that's what their plan was. Verse 7. Now you can go ahead and read the rest of that. Black man, the Ethiopian, came and rescued Jeremiah by appealing to Zedekiah and and saving him. He said he's going to die. And so they didn't have very much food to help him with, because it says, brethren, there was no bread in Jerusalem. It was getting awfully bad. And you know that almost overnight, you could see cities in this land with no bread. I mean, it doesn't even take much imagination to see that that could happen. I mean, everything is gone. We are into such deep indebtedness, trillions and trillions and trillions of dollars, that we could never pay it back. And we still don't understand that in most cases. And we're going to have to warn Judah, and we're going to have to warn Israel that it's coming again, and it's going to be much, much worse. But notice how this throne commission ties in directly to our work. Let's go back and read verse 10. Moreover, the word of the Eternal came unto me, saying, Jeremiah, what do you see? And I said, I see a rod of an almond tree. Well, this is actually verse 11. Excuse me, let me read 10 also. That's of Jeremiah 1, in case I didn't mention that. See, I have this day set you over the nations and over the kingdom to root out and to pull down and to destroy and to throw down and to build and to plant. And then in verse 11, moreover the word of the Eternal came unto me, saying, Jeremiah, what do you see? Now it gets right into our work from Jeremiah's commission. And I said, I see a rod of an almond tree. Then said the Eternal unto me, you have well seen, for I will hasten my word to perform it. And, I know you've read from Jeremiah that that means rod of an almond tree, a tree actually means a vigilant watchman. You can go back to the booklet of Jeremiah and read that. God's open door that he said he would give to us. And then in verse 13, and the word of the Eternal came unto me the second time, saying, well, what do you see? And I said, well, I see a seething pot. And the face thereof is toward the north. Then the Eternal said to me, out of the north an evil shall break forth upon all the inhabitants of the land. For lo, I will call all the families of the kingdoms of the north, says the Eternal, and they shall come. This is modern Babylon, king of the north. And they shall set every one on his throne at the entering of the gates of Jerusalem and against all the walls thereof round about and against all the cities of Judah. But here is a huge seething pot, and it's about to boil over. It's about to boil over. Now let me read to you some news here that I want to try to hurry and get through, because I think you need very badly to get some of this, and I'll just read as little as I can. But please take note of this, brethren, because it is that boiling pot, and it's ready to boil over. It's ready to boil over. Stratford has this to say, March 6th, while Germany faces the same pressures and pains as many other states in dealing with a global recession, it is not in the same boat as the rest. In fact, the recession is providing a wealth of opportunities for Berlin to expand its influence. Put simply, the Germans face more opportunities than threats from the global recession. Now, why would they be opportunities? Well, they're making bilateral deals, reached on, in other words, they're helping only nations they want to help. They're making bilateral deals reached on a case-by-case basis rather than on with an EU effort, just throwing it out there for everybody like we do, in which German control of the bailout would be only loosely corrected, or excuse me, correlated, if at all, with its economic contributions. It talks about them forcing the European Union into what they want to do. Germany, in attempting to extend its own financial system writ large over all of Europe. Germany is also in a geographic and trade position to dominate whatever emerges from the wreckage of this recession. Now what does that mean? What does that mean, brethren, when you think about it? Well, it means whatever is going to come out of that, all of those 27 countries, the 10 kings are going to come out of that, and Germany is going to have them by the throat financially. In other words, they're going to call the shots just like it says in all those prophecies. They're going to tell them what to do. And this is Stratford saying that. This is not our writers. In post-recession Europe, in which the Germans have rewritten the rules of finance, these states will be utterly dependent upon the Germans for their livelihood. Well, isn't that convenient? Well, you'd think there'd be an outcry about that. Well, you'd think we'd be up in arms about that. That's so undemocratic. How foolish we are. Which brings us back to the beginning. To achieve security for itself, Germany either must defeat its neighbors or become indispensable to them. Nazi Germany failed at the first. And listen to this. This is Stratford. He's not in our church. But with this recession, Germany is on the verge of becoming, and let me back up and read, Nazi Germany failed at the first. But with this recession, Germany is on the verge of becoming the indispensable player geographically, financially, and economically. It may not be acquiring Lebensraum in the strict sense, but to Germany's neighbors, Berlin's gains are going to feel disturbingly close. What is he talking about? He's talking about the Holy Roman Empire and Germany ruling Europe with a rod of iron. And there's another article here about the Fourth Reich is planned and a question mark. Well, and that's good. One more comment here from Stratford, though. This is critical. The solution or mitigation to the problem is for Germany to develop and maintain a strong economy, not simply for national unification. This is Stratford again. But also, remember, this is the guy that listened to Mr. Armstrong as he grew up. Got some pretty good knowledge there, and I think has insight from that understanding and that knowledge. But he says it's not simply for national unification, but also to develop economic links with its immediate neighbors. In theory, if the neighbors see their economic links to Germany as indispensable, they will be more likely to view military issues from the German viewpoint. Good insight, because that's exactly what prophecy says is going to happen. Exactly. They're going to support the military, and that's bad news for Europe and the world. And that's what we've been talking about for some 70 years. And here it is, staring us in the face. Just like the Bible prophecies told us, and just like Mr. Armstrong told us all those years. A couple more quotes and then I'll conclude that. Everyone is turning to Germany as the ultimate savior. This is, well, I'll give you the source. Everyone is turning to Germany as the ultimate savior of the European economy. Reuters columnist Paul Taylor wrote last week, Germany is a savior. And Germany does it how? How are they doing this? It goes on to say, Europe's change of heart toward Germany, Taylor wrote, reflects a shift in the balance of power in the EU that puts Germany in the driver's seat. Germany's apparent willingness to support its neighbors reflects a change in direction for the leadership, Spiegel reported last week. Until now, Germany has been reluctant to offer to help pay for what it sees as other countries' lack of discipline. As a result, it is expected that extensive strings will be attached to any assistance offered, a point made clear by President of Germany's Bundesbank, Axel Weber. Speaking to German daily Die Welt, he said, quote, targeted aid for individual member states may be unavoidable, but any such moves would have to be accompanied with strict demands and conditions. And oh yes, we've always said that the European Union is going to be hijacked by the Daniel 8 man, and then he's going to have the 10 kings, and then there's going to be Satan the devil enter into him, and then you're going to see death and destruction like you've never ever seen it on this earth. And it's right there facing us today. I believe that the foundation of the 10 kings is being laid right now. Satan, the god of that system, is getting them prepared for that Daniel 8 man that just may come on the scene September the 27th when Germany has their election. You know what's really interesting, brethren? I don't know how many times I heard Mr. Armstrong say, he said, I think what it's going to take to jolt the EU into uniting is going to be the collapse of the dollar or the Western currency, which is underpinned by the dollar, was, the collapse of the dollar, and that will galvanize them into uniting. He said that many times. Was that man led by God? Was he a special man? Or was he just another human being? It is remarkable that he made that statement. And here we see it happening right before our eyes. It is the collapse of the dollar that's uniting them, and uniting them in a way where Germany has a stranglehold on every one of them. Guided, of course, by a great religious leader. I'll tell you, we'd better be carefully scrutinizing Europe. Because you know something? That's going to come on the scene suddenly. And it's going to shock the world when they see what a powerhouse that EU is then. Here is what the International Herald Tribune says. The global financial crisis threatens to strike Germany and the rest of the European Union with a hurricane-like force in the next 3 to 6 months, just before the election in Germany. As the world's leading exporter and Europe's primary economic engine, Germany is already enduring its worst recession since 1990. And as world trade shrinks and layoffs mount, Germany's downward spiral could further fragment the 27-nation EU. This is from February the 26th. It could also jeopardize Berlin's ability to work closely with the United States on a common strategic agenda ranging from Afghanistan to the Middle East. A tectonic political shift is likely to occur with the September 27 national elections. Interesting, isn't it, that people in the world can see that? The governing Grand Coalition, this article says, linking Chancellor Angela Merkel's Christian Democrats with the left-of-center Social Democrats, now seems doomed despite its 75% majority in the parliament. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean she'll be kicked out, but they see there's going to be a big shakeup there, and it probably does mean she's going to be gone. And the Daniel 8 man's coming in. Well, certainly, that is a great possibility, brethren. I mean to tell you, it seems to me like the timeline is just right for that to happen. With EU institutions in limbo, the article continues, the economy under growing pressure, and the entire country riveted by the September national elections, Germany seems likely to enter a phase of protracted inward focus. It is shaping up to be a perilous year for Europe and the world. 2009 is shaping up to be a perilous year for Europe and the world. Brethren, it is here. All those prophecies we've been talking about all this time, I mean, they are there every week for us to see, it seems. And, well, we'll look at what's happening to America. Mexico is providing 90% of the cocaine that comes into the United States, and now we've got these people that are, I mean, if you get in their way down in Mexico now, they cut your head off or whatever they want to do, anything to get the drugs up here and make all those billions of dollars. And the United States is so addicted to drugs, brethren, so addicted to drugs that they're about to bring the whole nation of Mexico down. And these gun runners and drug runners are taking over Mexico. Because of our drug addiction, our sickness, we're so sodded with drugs, we don't know anything. Mexico sold California alone $14 billion worth of marijuana. Well, that's right, it came from Mexico. And they've got a $42 billion deficit. And a lot of them are high on marijuana, I suppose. Do you see why God would bring them down? Citibank was our largest bank and has now dropped down to about a dollar a share. Even less than a dollar for a little while last week. And they said it has the value now less than Clorox bleach. What does it all mean, brethren? What does it all mean that this is happening now? Worst unemployment in the U.S. In 25 years, that goes back before Mr. Armstrong died, 700,000 people lost their job in February. 27% of Americans worry that and can't sleep at night because they're getting troubled by all of this. And we are going to have to get this message out, brethren, in spite of the economic problems. Our income decreased 12% in the first 2 months of this year. But we have to get this job done, and I know we really have to pray about that and do everything we can, brethren. But the unemployment has afflicted the church as well. It's going to hurt the church, but it's also going to help us get more laborers. But always keep in mind, brethren, the bulk of this is going to have to be done by God's people. And we do need to be thinking about that on these holy days. Because God is just flinging open the doors so that we can walk through them. And I think they're going to be opening a lot more so that we can get laborers. And many of them will be Laodiceans, and we are already seeing an evidence of that. Now, here's what Mr. Armstrong wrote years ago. He said, "Can't we rally stronger than ever to the greatest cause ever commissioned to any people? I know from sorrowful experience that unless you keep hearing from me, many of you will let up your effort and totally neglect the precious work of God." Well, I hope that's not true of us, brethren. I hope that's not true of us. We're the only ones that are going to do this work and get the job done, and we need to think about giving more and not less. Because we truly do have such a little tiny sliver of time left to do the job. You can read in verse 16 of Jeremiah 1 where God talks about those that have forsaken Him. 95% of God's people that have turned away from Him. And then in verse 17, God says, "You get out there, you gird up your loins, and you do what I command you, lest I confound you before them," or lest I... The Hebrew says, "break you in pieces." I mean, God is pretty strong here as He talks about us. He says, "You get out there. You deliver the message. You get the job done. Or I'm going to break you in pieces." Now, that's not harsh, brethren. That's mercy. Because we know everything. And there's no excuse for us not doing this job. And He says, "I'll make you as brazen walls and an iron pillar against the princes and the leaders of this world, that you don't have to worry, that you're going to prevail, and nobody can stop us because," He says, "I am with you." I just think it's interesting when you look at the Jews and the problems they're going through today, and They're using this archaeology dig to try to get people excited about keeping Jerusalem united, keeping it as one city. And then they talk about all the blood that's been spilled in the past. And then this one guy, Shmuel Schnitzer, we've written about several times, he says, "Oh, the Bible today is just a curiosity. It's not our calling card the way it once was. Joshua and what happened in this land, and all those examples told to us in the book of Joshua doesn't mean anything to us anymore. The Bible doesn't mean anything to the Jews, at least not like it should. Nor does it to Israel. Here's what it says." In the foundation document, the Jewish People's Council concluded in 1948 proclamation by saying that Israel's founding fathers had placed their trust in the rock of Israel. Israel's birth certificate begins with the Bible and ends with faith in God. See, well, does it really? No, it doesn't today, and a lot of people are noticing that. Well, what does the Bible mean to us? Could that really be the problem? Yes, it is the problem. And it's a lot worse than they think. And when we talk about Judah's wound, that is a wound unto death. Because they're trusting men and they're not trusting the God of the Bible and the Hebrew Bible that they have and talk about so much. But certainly need to do a lot more obeying and looking to God, the God of peace, for to solve their problems. I'll tell you this, brethren. We'd better focus on that conclusion to all of this and David's throne and look to the future, and I mean the immediate future. And the people are going, Israel's going to need to know about this message. And when they get into that holocaust of all holocausts, they're going to need to know that there is hope. And when you look at how close this all is, as I said on a TV program, I really believe this. I think that the Father and Christ and the angels are all up there in heaven planning and preparing right now, very fervently, for the return of Jesus Christ to this world. How could they not be when it's to happen so very, very soon? And He's going to come to the and return to the very spot where we're digging over there right now. And God says that He will open up doors for us, and He wants us to have the money to walk through those doors and to get this message out and fulfill Isaiah 40, where we're to go to the Laodiceans and go to the cities of Judah and go to all Israel and say to all of them and use this throne as a constant reminder that we are to say to the cities of Judah and to all Israel, behold your God.